The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We have the Book Nook coming up for you. And returning to the program today, the Scottish crime novelist Ian Rankin. It has been 30 years since he introduced his character John Rebus, and he is celebrating his 30th anniversary of the series in the United Kingdom this year. Next year, it'll be 30 years in the U.S. His books were staggered, and the debut came out a year later over here. We're going to hear about the celebration of Ian Rankin's 30th anniversary and his new John Rebus novel right after NPR News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Ian Rankin. Hello, Ian.
Hey, nice to talk to you, Vic.
Ian, you've got a new novel out. It's called Rather Be the Devil, and this is another Rebus. And is this like a big anniversary for you? Isn't this like 30 years of Rebus?
Yeah, in the UK, it's 30 years this year since the first book was launched. Stateside, it will be next year we'll be celebrating that, because the American publication of the first book was a little bit behind the UK publication. But yeah, 30 years I've had this guy inside my head.
Well, I usually will start an interview about a Rebus novel by asking you to tell me about Rebus, and you usually tell me about Rebus the detective, Rebus the guy that retired. But there's more to the history. Let's go way back to the beginning of Rebus. Let's go back to Fife. Who was this guy? Who is this guy?
Well, he grew up in the same small coal mining village that I did, and went to the same high school. But at some point, our lives diverged. He left school 15 with very few qualifications, and he's a generation older than me, and at that time in Fife, there weren't too many jobs for young, uneducated men, so he joined the army for a while, and then when he was kicked out of the army, he kicked around a little bit and eventually joined the police. Now, how I relate to all that, I just don't know. I mean, I grew up in a blue-collar family. I was the first member of my family to go to college or university. But I knew a lot of guys like him. I knew a lot of young men who had been at high school with me and had left with few qualifications and not much in the way of job prospects. And I think, I always felt to me when I was writing the very first book as if Rebus was like the big brother that I didn't have.
Mm.
You know, he was like an older brother who had gone off into the world and made his own way and had very different life experiences from me, but who shared some of my, shared my background, shared the family history, and maybe a little bit of the same philosophy of life.
And Rebus has been married, and we used to get a glimpse of his ex-wife, Rona, early on. We did see his daughter in a recent book, that one where he kept driving up north. But mm-hmm. They're kind of out of the picture mostly, aren't they?
Well, they're out of the picture mostly because, you know, I wanted to focus on this story. And this is why we have, I think, so many maverick cops and loner cops in our fiction, is because, you know, if there's a family there, if there are familial ties, then there's certain things that you might feel you have to do. So your cop has to go home at 6 p.m. because dinner is waiting, or they've got an appointment with a cinema with their partner, or, you know, their kid's birthday's coming up, or they've got to take their kid to a football game. And that just gets in the way of the plot. It gets in the way of the storytelling, and it slows down the narrative. And I wanted my guy, my detective, to be completely focused and obsessed with the crime-solving element of the story. And that meant pushing friendships and family relations to the margins of the book. Now, having said that, in the recent books, his daughter, who he's back in touch with, she's not been on the scene for a while, and she does live quite a long way away from him, but she's got a baby now, so Rebus is a grandfather, and so I've got to try and think, how would he feel about that, and how would he react to that situation when he's in the same room as his grandkid? And he feels a little bit awkward, and he's not really sure what to do. He's not very comfortable in those social situations.
Yeah, he's not a warm and fuzzy guy. My guess is Ian Rankin, his new novel, is Rather Be the Devil. Now, the last few, you've been getting the titles from song lyrics. Where'd you get the title for this one?
Rather Be the Devil was a song that I first encountered when I was about 14 or 15. It's a song on an album called Solid Air by a British musician, Anglo-Scottish musician called John Martin. And it's one of my favorite albums of all time. And it's an old blues song. It's an old Skip James tune, I think. And it's called I'd Rather Be the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want that first-person thing. I didn't want readers to think, oh, it's going to be a first-person narrative, or who is this I? So I wanted it to be a bit more general than that. So I cut it back to Rather Be the Devil. But yeah, I mean, for some reason, the recent books have been based on song lyrics and titles by dead musicians. A bit worrying, you know. I started off with a couple of titles from a friend of mine, Jackie Leaven, a musician who died young. And then for the book before this one, it was a song by The Associates, Even Dogs in the Wild. And their lead singer, Billy McKenzie, committed suicide at a very young age. And now we've got John Martin, who died a few years ago, having led a fairly rock and roll lifestyle, shall we say, not taking too much care of himself. And I think that's what Rebus relates to when he listens to John Martin, that here's a maverick musician that my maverick cop would enjoy listening to.
Well, Rebus is as big a music fan as you are, Ian. And
I've just joined a band, Vic. I shouldn't tell you that, but I have.
You're back in a band?
Yeah, I know. It's been 40 years since I've sang, but there's a dad band. It's a dad band. It's all guys in their 50s, and, you know, we've all got mostly jobs in the media or a mixture of things, and we get together and we just rehearse on a Monday night, and I'm back to vocals again, but I'm afraid my vocal range hasn't improved much in the past 40 years.
Not since the Dancing Pigs?
Not since the days of the Dancing Pigs, the second best punk band in Fife.
Well, we had Peter Hook back on the show last week, and wow. Have you seen that New Order book?
Yeah, Substance. That's a chunky book.
Yeah, I'll say.
When he was in Edinburgh touring with a book, I managed to meet him for a few minutes backstage, and I said, you know, I was getting the book signed, and I said, I didn't realize you were in New Order for that long. You know, it's just a huge book. But of course he was. He was in the band for a long time. I've interviewed him once at the Edinburgh Book Festival on stage in front of an audience. And I've been to some of his recent gigs. He's a terrific terrific musician. But also he's keeping the legacy of both those bands going. You know, I mean, Joy Division, he'll do a whole set of Joy Division songs, then a set of New Order songs. And he plays for a couple of hours, and it's great live. If anybody wants to see him live, they should do so.
Well, Ian, I guess we better talk about your new book. Let's talk about the fact that you were just saying that Rebus doesn't have a family. You know, you're going with the story. But Rebus used to have dates with glasses of booze, and he used to have dates with cigarettes. And in this story, those are few and far between. No cigarettes and just an occasional drink. He's really cranky in this one because he's not doing the things that he enjoys.
Yeah, well, I mean, as Leonard Cohen says, he aches in the places where he used to play. You know, he's a guy in his mid-60s who hasn't looked after himself, smoking, drinking, eating all the wrong foods, no exercise. So eventually his luck had to run out. And, you know, I sat down with a doctor, a GP, a general practitioner, and said, what would you expect this guy to present if he walked into your surgery? And we came up with a few, you know, ideas, and I decided that he was going to have these health issues. The most recent books really are dealing with mortality, the fact that mortality is tapping people like Rebus and Big Jer Cafferty on the shoulder. You know, they're men in their mid-60s, and they're sort of looking around them, and people are dying around them, and they're saying, well, you know, how much longer have I got? And that, you know, to me, that keeps the series fresh, you know, because the detective, the main character, changes during the course of the series. He gets older, and the things happen to him that would happen to most of us. And so each book is almost like a standalone. It's like he's having to deal with the story from a different perspective. I mean, in this latest book, he cannot use his physical heft to intimidate suspects in a way that he would have before. He's also retired, so he's not carrying a badge, so there are people can refuse to talk to him. So he's got to find new ways of dealing with these situations, and that keeps me on my toes. It means that I can't just rest and say, okay, I know what people want from this character in this book, it will be much the same as the previous book, because the world has moved on and he has moved on. And, you know, his relationship with the gangster, Big Jer Cafferty, continues to fascinate me, because these are two old, you know, boxers, old heavyweight boxers, who just refuse to leave the ring. You know, they're surrounded by much younger, fitter, hungrier people in the same line of work as them. And they're looking around bewildered at the way the world is changing and wondering if they still have any useful role to play.
Big Jer Cafferty is the longtime crime boss in Edinburgh, and he's kind of been fading away a little bit in the last few books, just like John Rebus supposedly was. But in this one, both of them are really wrestling with retirement, and Big Jer, he'd kind of had a protege there for a while who came into the books a few books ago, Daryl Christie. But Daryl Christie is a very aggressive, up-and-coming young hood, and Big Jer is having some issues with that. In fact, this is a really strong book for Jerry Cafferty. Man, he's all over the place in this one.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the previous book, Even Dogs in the Wild, there's a scene at a funeral, and there's Rebus and Cafferty there, and Rebus is kind of wondering if Cafferty, you know, is happy to have retired, to have left Edinburgh open to younger, hungrier villains to come along and carve up his territory. And Cafferty walks away and holds up a finger to say that he's got one fight left in him. And I think this novel follows on. It's like a segue. It just follows on from that moment. And this is the story of Cafferty's last good fight, I suppose. And he really is. He's quite a Machiavellian character. He's sort of, you know, you're never sure exactly whose strings he's pulling or what his long-term goals are. Or, you know, he's a guy who thinks long-term, so you're never sure what's behind every move that he makes. And that, you know, that, Rebus likes that. Rebus likes an adversary who is challenging, you know, and who's clever, who's sharp. He's not just using violence as a way of getting what he wants. He's actually a lot shrewder than that. He's a chess player. And he's moving the pieces around. He's moving the people around the board. And, you know, they don't know he's doing it. They're just moving from one place to the next, to a situation from one situation to the next, not knowing that he's the one, you know, making them go to that square or that square. So he's an absolutely fascinating character, which is why he stuck around. You know, he was invented, really, to only be in book 3 of the series. So that's 18 books ago. But he just got under my skin. I thought, there's so much I can do with you. And you need someone like that. You need a kind of Moriarty figure who's going to represent all the bad stuff that's going on in the world.
And since you are the second most famous crime writer out of Edinburgh, I guess Moriarty, that's appropriate, huh?
Kind of. I mean, we all live under that shadow that Arthur Conan Doyle, son of Edinburgh, lived there when he was young, went to Edinburgh University, based Sherlock Holmes partly on one of his lecturers, one of the tutors at the university, but left very soon, you know, and decided he would set his books in London, and Sherlock Holmes would very much be a London detective. But yeah, I mean, if you can actually hear recordings of him. There's some audio recordings of Conan Doyle when he was an old man. I guess he would be in his 70s or 80s, but he's still got a very definite Scottish accent, which I found absolutely fascinating when I heard it. But yeah, we all live under his shadow. There's a Sherlock Holmes statue in Edinburgh, and there's a Conan Doyle pub, and there's all these sort of walking tours where you can walk in the footsteps of people like Conan Doyle.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Ian Rankin, and we'll continue our conversation right after this. My guest is Ian Rankin. Ian, aren't they having some kind of a big brouhaha for you this year in Edinburgh?
To celebrate 30 years of Rebus, my publisher decided, you know, we thought, what can we do? What could be different? And so we're doing a festival. There's a Rebus festival, the last day of June, first day of July in Edinburgh. It's going to be a mixture. It's going to be live music. Going to have a couple of bands and singer-songwriters playing, people that I like, people that I think Rebus would like. I'll be doing a little DJ set, maybe myself, choosing some of Rebus's favorite tunes. There's going to be a walking tour, a pub quiz. We're going to show, I don't know, a TV episode or a film at the cinema. There's going to be a bunch of stuff. I've got a graphic artist, who does graphic novels. He's going to, I've given him my 10 favorite moments from the series, and he's doing them as individual portraits, which will then, we'll be giving them away as postcards and posters and things. So it's going to be all, and it's going to be a special whiskey, a limited edition whiskey, Rebus whiskey, and there's all sorts of stuff planned, but it's still in the early stages. I think it'll probably on my website mid-March we will announce what's actually going to happen.
So is that going to be like a Laphroaig or an Oban Rebus?
It's going to be Highland Park.
Really?
Which is from the Isle of Orkney. And for Rebus's 20th anniversary, they did a little limited edition run, but it was never for sale. It was only, we just auctioned it off for charity. This one, I think, is going to be in the shops and the stores for sale. So, yeah, that's the plan, but let's wait and see what happens.
Do you still have one of those 20-year malts stashed away somewhere in your house?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I mean, there were about 120 bottles in total, but they've pretty much all gone now, because it was just the contents of one cask. Uh-huh. So that's around about 120 bottles. But it was a beautiful thing. It was in a special bottle, and then it was inside a special wooden box, all kind of branded with Rebus's name and stuff. So it was. You know, they come up for sale occasionally at auction. People who've won them in raffles or in competitions then sell them on. And it fetches silly money because it's so rare, and Highland Park is such a respected malt whiskey distillery.
In case you're just joining us, Ian Rankin is on the telephone in Boston. We're talking about his Rebus novel, Rather Be the Devil, or at least we start talking about it, and then we kind of go off somewhere. Let's talk about this cold case that Rebus is working on, because that's what he's doing in retirement.
Yeah, I mean, it gives me, I won't say difficulties, but it gives me challenges. I've got to, okay, he's a retired cop. You know, how much can he do? What could he actually do? And how can I inveigle him into an active police inquiry? But, you know, I knew that, you know, he will have been, in his mind, he is storing all the cases he worked on that he never got a satisfactory result from. So all the cold cases, all the cases where he never found out who'd done it, are kind of sitting there. So I've made a physical manifestation of that. I've decided that in the spare bedroom in his apartment will be boxes and boxes of notes and newspaper clippings from these cases down the years. And, you know, he's out for dinner with his lady friend, and, you know, they're in a restaurant, and he starts to tell her a story, and it's a story of a murder of a socialite, a rich woman who was killed in this hotel back in 1978, which is the year that I arrived in Edinburgh as a student. So I'm kind of harking back to my time when I arrived in Edinburgh, and the place was still strange and wondrous to me. Mm-hmm. He thinks about it. He thinks, well, I never got a result from that. And he starts to look into it. And then there are resonances with something that's actually happening at the moment. Someone who was tangentially connected to that case has gone missing. And so that brings Rebus into the purview of the actual police inquiry. People like Siobhan Clark, his one-time partner, police partner, and Malcolm Fox, who at one time was antagonistic towards Rebus because he was an internal affairs cop who was trying to get Rebus kicked off the force. And so I get the three of them of this little dance that they do, Rebus trying to work his way into a live police investigation while the cops aren't sure they want a civilian to be that closely involved.
And Rebus's investigation of this ancient case also gives him a pretext to go and question a guy who he really admired once upon a time.
That would be Mr. Collier, my musician.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had a lot of fun with that. Well, I just thought, you know, this five-star hotel in Edinburgh, 1978, who would be there? You know, who would the police be looking at? You know, there'd be some fairly, you know, could be fairly well-known people there. There'd be some rich people there. And it's right around the corner from the biggest music venue in Edinburgh, the Usher Hall. I used to go there when I, even before I arrived at Edinburgh to go to university, I would go over there from my high school of an evening to go to gigs and see bands like the sensational Alex Harvey Band and Jethro Tull and the Kinks and stuff like that, Genesis. So I thought, okay, so there'll be a musician, a big shot musician, who's staying at the hotel, and him and his entourage will have been questioned by the police, and potentially one of them could be a suspect in the case. And that's a lot of fun because, as you well know, Vic, I'm a frustrated rock star and would much rather be a rock star than be a writer. I just don't have the chops for it. So, you know, so it was great fun to invent this guy who, I don't know, I think he owes a little bit to a Scottish musician, Frankie Miller, physically, probably also owes a little bit with his career trajectory to Phil Collins, because he's been in a successful band, but he's left and gone solo, and he's made a solo career covering old songs. I don't know, maybe there's a little bit of Rod Stewart in there as well when I think about it. But anyway, he's very much a fictional character, honestly, Gov. But it's great because, you know, Rebus has all these old albums, and Rebus gets to track him down and ask him a few questions, and you start to get a little bit of antagonism there. And also, meant I could mention my favourite record shop, record store from when I was a kid, which is Brucey's, which is was a real record store in Fife, where I grew up, but also in Edinburgh. And it run by a guy called Bruce Findlay, who I have got to know in later years, who lives in Edinburgh. So it was a thrill to have Rebus actually reminisce about his time going to Bruce's record shop, and then have Bruce Findlay read the book and get in touch to say how thrilled he was to see that.
Did you see Genesis when Peter Gabriel was still with him?
No, I saw them after Peter Gabriel left. It's one of those nights in my life that I look back on and think I took a wrong road. There was a busload of us who went from Fife over to Edinburgh, and half the bus was going to see Wind and Wuthering era Genesis, and half the bus was going to see Rory Gallagher.
Well,
and I was the wrong half of the bus. You know, in retrospect, I should have gone to see Rory Gallagher.
Yeah, you certainly loved him.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a thrill when, I mentioned him in a few of the books. And then Rory's brother, Donald, got in touch and said, did you know he was a huge fan of American crime fiction? And I had no idea. He loved all the Golden Age American detective stories, and referenced him in some of his songs. And so we ended up doing a project together, Kickback City, which was a collection of Rory's songs based on American crime novels. And I wrote a short story for it, and we got Aidan Quinn to narrate the short story, and it came out as a really nice package with the short story included. And the story was set in the 50s, and it was set in LA, and I tried to get in as many references to, you know, from Rory's music book tastes as I could. So that was a lot of fun. But I never did see him live. I mean, you know, I was a great fan of his music, but never saw him live.
My guest is Ian Rankin. His book is Rather Be the Devil. And as I mentioned earlier, Cafferty is coming back strong in this book. And you have one of my favorite encounters is a brief one in the story where Cafferty tracks down this real loser named Crawshand. And he goes over to this guy's place, and it's pretty disgusting. And then when Cafferty leaves, he catches a cab, and the cab driver pulls up, and he says, snow later, maybe. And I loved Cafferty's response. I mean, that really said it all.
Yeah. Let's not say, because I think there's a swear word involved.
Yeah, right.
So we might not want to mention it on the radio. But yeah, no, the thing about Cafferty is fans had been saying recently to me, oh, I love him. He's such a great, he's become a big cuddly bear of a guy. And I thought, whoa, that's not what I want him to be. So the last couple of books, you know, he's got a bit more edge to him. And every now and again, I just want to remind the reader, this is not a nice guy.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's a sort of, you know, he's in some ways, I guess, he's potentially a sociopath or a psychopath. You know, he can suddenly turn. So he can be charming and quiet, and he's well-dressed, he's dapper, he looks like a successful businessman. But you say the wrong thing to him, or you catch him at the wrong moment, and suddenly he's a very dangerous individual. And we get a sense of that in this book. On the other hand, there are still moments of humor. I mean, there's some humor in his response to the cab driver. some of the stuff he says to Rebus when the two of them meet in cafes. One of my favorite things, without giving away too much, but one of my favorite things is his reason for buying two hammers.
Right.
When one would do.
Yeah.
One would do, but he ends up buying two. And I'm not going to give away why, but that was one of my... I just, when I came up with that line, I just smiled.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, that's that's good. All right. I did like that. My guest is Ian Rankin, and let's talk a little bit about Malcolm Fox, because in this one, Malcolm and Siobhan had kind of had a relationship going there for a while, but now things are on the outs between them. And Malcolm, you've had a lot of reorganization in the police up there. Malcolm is who are these guys he's working with? I didn't quite understand what their place was and their frame of reference.
Right. Well, I mean, there was a huge reorganization, restructuring of the police force in Scotland recently. And as part of that, they built this brand new facility, the Scottish Crime Campus. So it looks like a sort of a college or a university, albeit behind very secure, high barbed wire. And I was able to get a visit there, a year or two back, to get a little tour of the place. And it's where all the senior cops in Scotland hang out, but as well as that, there are the prosecutors, so you've got the kind of legal people there as well, and on top of that, you've got Internal Revenue, the people who investigate fraud cases and stuff. So you've got serious crimes, terrorism, all that stuff, all these big players are in the one building, and the philosophy behind that is that they can then easily exchange information. They don't feel like they're having to protect their own kind of corner. And, you know, I haven't got a tour of it. I thought, you know, the kind of person who would be promoted to this sort of job would be someone like Malcolm Fox, because he's seen very much as being a safe pair of hands, a team player. He's not a maverick. He's not going to cross the line. And I thought, oh, well, if he gets promoted there, then that's really going to annoy Siobhan Clark, who feels that she's a much better qualified cop than him. And that it really, she should be the one getting that promotion. So that changes their dynamic, and that makes it interesting for me again when I come to write the new book. So that's why I did it. I did it because, A, I thought it's the sort of thing that would happen anyway, and B, it changes the dynamic between those two individuals and means that they're not nearly as close as they once were. And it's, again, it's about not being comfortable. It's when I sit down to write a book, I don't want to be comfortable. I don't want to think I'm just easing into an old pair of slippers here.
Mm-hmm.
I want to challenge myself. So I need the characters to be changing, to be evolving, to allow me to be challenged. And, you know, so that I don't get lazy when I'm writing the books. And then that changes their relationship with Rebus as well, because they both want to go and talk to Rebus about how they feel about the other one. So there's all kinds of interesting things that happen. And in fact, you know, I made a mistake, because when the book was published, someone got in touch from the Scottish Crime Campus, someone from Internal Affairs, and said, yeah, the thing that you've got Malcolm doing, we probably wouldn't do that from here. It would probably be our other office down in England who would be in charge of that. And my only defense was, yeah, but if it had been the office down in England in charge of it, I wouldn't have a book. you know, that's my only defense,
yeah.
Is it had to be based in Scotland, yeah. Or I didn't have a book.
Good point. Well, for those of us who have been following you all these years, when you put Rebus on hiatus there for a little while and we had those Malcolm Fox books, Malcolm wasn't a particularly likable character. But as we've been reading the last couple, I, as a reader, have really started to like him a lot. He's starting to kind of get what Rebus is all about, and he's not quite so antagonistic.
Right, right. And yet there's still that edginess between them. So, for example, in this book, when Rebus has this illness, he doesn't feel that he can tell Siobhan Clark about it because she would sympathize.
Mm.
The only person he can talk to about it is Malcolm Fox, because I think he says to Fox, you don't like me enough to be all full of tea and sympathy, and that's why I'm telling you. So that tells you something about the dynamic between the two characters as well and the way things have changed. But, you know, changed slightly or changed, you know, they're not, you know, they're never going to become bosom buddies. They're never going to become bosom buddies. They respect each other more than they used to. And there is a kind of, you know, there's an inkling of a friendship there, but there's always going to be that distance between them. Because, you know, in the background lurks the fact that Malcolm Fox used to be the kind of cop who wanted a cop like Rebus kicked off the force or put away. He just felt Rebus was a dinosaur. His way of policing didn't work in the 21st century, and he's probably right, you know, he's probably right, which is why I can have some fun with Rebus having retired, because he no longer has to obey the rules or, you know, he can cross the line as often as he likes now. The frustrating thing is when he tries to be a detective, he finds that his way of doing things doesn't work anymore. He goes looking for the old bars where he used to have a network of informers, and he finds that the informers have died or gone gaga, and that the bars have been turned into bistros and cafes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ian, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Nice talking to you, Vic.
And I take it you've been up at the Bolt Hall recently working on the next book?
No, man, I'm having a year off. This is my sabbatical year.
Good for you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but with all the kind of Rebus 30 stuff that's going on, all the celebrations and doing a lot of touring, and I'm touring the States, I'm touring Australia, New Zealand, I'm touring Germany, as well as the UK. So there's quite a lot of touring going on. I've got Bali later in the year. There's a literary festival there, believe it or not. So with all that stuff going on, I thought, yeah, I'm not going to have much time. So instead of that, I'm tinkering with a stage play, and I'm writing some short stories, and that's just about it, I think. And that'll do me. And then later this year, I'll start to think about the next one.
And you've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Ian Rankin. And we have a little extra time in the program for you today. We're going to bring you a treat. Ian Rankin reading one of his short stories and some music from his old pal, Jackie Leaven. Jackie Leaven wrote a couple of songs that became titles of Ian Rankin novels featuring John Rebus. We'll bring you this musical and spoken word addition to the Book Nook right after this. Good morning. It's time for our Book Nook bonus. We had an interview this morning with Ian Rankin, and back in 2004, he appeared at Queen's Hall in Edinburgh, Scotland, with his friend Jackie Leaven, and they recorded an audio book. And Ian did some readings, he read some short stories, and his friend Jackie recorded some music, and it came out on an audiobook, and we're going to bring you Ian Rankin reading one of his stories next in the Book Nook.
Ready to rock and roll?
Yep.
This is a story that, for obvious reasons, or reasons that will become obvious, is called Jackie Leaven Said. Da 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 da. Edward Hall reached down and turned off the car stereo, the better to concentrate on his surroundings. He'd been away so long he barely knew the place, but it seemed to know him. Kirkcaldy. Down in London, his home these past 20-odd years, nobody could spell it. And if he wrote it down for any of his friends, they'd look at the word like it was some exotic foreign language. Kirkcaldy? Kirkcaldy? It's no harder than Mary LeBone, Edward argued for a while. Then he just gave up. When asked where he grew up, he'd say Edinburgh or Dundee. Even Dundee stumped some of them until he mentioned the Beano, the Dandy, the Associates. And these days, of course, most of them didn't even remember the Associates. Just one more contentious issue in Edward's hard-pressed, urbanized life. He ran a studio in Crouch End, lived 5 minutes' walk from work in a rambling, four-story terraced house on Ridge Road with views of Alexandra Palace. It was a good area, a smattering of DJs and musicians. He sometimes saw Dave Stewart to talk to. Andy Kershaw might be buying organic tea at the deli on the Broadway. One time, Bob Dylan had left the local cafe not 3 minutes before Edward arrived for his morning latte. A good area. And people knew him, not for his past life, the music he'd made, bands he'd played in, but because people used his studio. Boy bands with record company money pinned to them like so many acupuncture needles. Christ. He hated it when the boy bands came to do a session. You got the schoolgirls outside, and that meant you got the van drivers honking their horns, which in turn got the neighbours complaining. The problem with London, there were always neighbours. The old warehouse across the street from his studio had been turned into apartments. Not flats, mind you, apartments. And not just any old apartments, luxury, lifestyle, lofted living for the ultimate urban adventure. Snapped up by young professionals who were unimpressed by the names ferried to and from EH Studios, Edward had spent a small fortune soundproofing the building, only to find himself banjaxed by school truants with a penchant for pouting but otherwise talent-shy pretty boys. Only a few days back, a waif-like A&R girl had been standing by the mixing desk while her gel-headed protégés had tried finishing the harmonies on their grievous rendition of Python Lee Jackson's In a Broken Dream. "What do you think?" she'd asked. "If I'm being honest, love, it gives me the boke," Edward had said. She'd nodded and smiled, taking it for praise. Maybe the latest North London street slang. Oh, yes, there were times when it was nice to fall back on the good Scots tongue. But then his mobile had rung. Not the one in the studio, but his mobile. And not his everyday mobile, but the one only close family and closer friends had the number for. And picking up, he'd heard his brother's voice telling him their mother was dead. So now his assistant Sean was back in London taking charge for a few days. Nothing onerous on the schedule. The music for two telly ads and a three-track demo for a Soho jazz singer who seemed to save up all year for the privilege of handing it all over for 15 minutes of tape time. This was her third visit. "She's a trier," Edward had told Sean, "so do your best for her. No shortcuts." A pause for thought. "And no sneaking your mates in for free time." Sean had looked shocked. But Edward knew they'd do it anyway. Sean fancied himself as the DJ shadow type and hung around with like-minded peely-wally souls, all of them champing at the bit to be discovered outside the tightly-knit world of illicit dance parties and privately pressed CDs. Edward didn't really understand the music. In the pub, Sean would call him a Luddite and a sad old trad, as if tradition was something to be embarrassed about. Jesus, where the hell was he? Managed to take a wrong turn somehow, and here he was heading for the Esplanade. He'd flown into Edinburgh, rented a car at Avis. The Mondeo he was sitting in was as upmarket as they went. In London, he drove a silver Boxster. It was garaged next to the studio, but the keys were in his jacket pocket. No way Sean was getting a sniff of that particular perk. The M90 north from Edinburgh had been fine. Over the bridge and back into Fife, he'd taken the Kirkcaldy slip road, not really recognising it, no landmarks to speak of. A new dual carriageway and then a series of signs and turns which had brought him here to the Esplanade. Memories came back. The annual Lynx Market, gangs from surrounding towns besieging the place, the old garrison disco, where, in the lad's toilets, he'd first tried a puff of the old cannabis sativa. The now-defunct bus station by the sea wall, places where he'd run and places where he'd snogged. Cafes visited, jukeboxes critiqued, the bowling alley in the arcade, the record shop where he'd first fallen under music's lifelong spell. Picking up a guitar from a window display, giving his mother an inkling of his next birthday present. His mother, now gone, heaven bound. 7, 8 years since he'd last seen her. There had always been invitations for her to visit him in London, and he really meant them. He wanted her to see the big house, the car, the studio. Wanted her to know that it was all his, that he was a success. but she wouldn't budge from Fife, and tomorrow they would bury her, him and his brother Jamie, leaving him no reason to come back here again, always supposing he could survive what was to come. He drove up St. Clair Street and eventually found a way into Hayfield, and now he recognised the roads, houses which hadn't changed in the 40 years since his mother and father had moved there. Jamie had said he would meet him at the old house. Edward parked by the gate and pulled the handbrake on. The curtains were closed downstairs and up. He remembered they'd had Venetian blinds at one time, his mother painstakingly dusting every slat. He didn't know when they'd been replaced, felt annoyed somehow that they'd gone, and here was lanky Jamie coming down the path, eyes everywhere but on the car, hair too long for his years, tucked behind both ears, face sallow and hanging. "How was the trip?" he asked as Edward got out of the car. "Fine." They stood 3 feet apart, no handshake or hug, and then eye contact was established, and Jamie tried a tentative smile, which Edward responded to with his most carefully chosen words of the day. "And how's my wife, Jamie? Are you still taking good care of her?"
Crack. Now they're broken sons bleeding tracks. Why he had to go, I don't know, he wouldn't say. Know the man, know the man, know the man, know the man. He wouldn't say goodbye to Jim Allmendinger. Goodbye to Jim Allmendinger. I say goodbye, goodbye, goodbye to Jim Allmendinger. And I can still see the roads winding down to the sea. I say goodbye to Jim Allmendinger. I say goodbye to Jim Allmendinger. I say goodbye, goodbye.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO with a little Book Nook bonus for you this morning. We heard Jackie Leaven performing a song called Jim Allmendinger, and before that, his pal Ian Rankin reading one of his short stories that was recorded at Queen's Hall in Edinburgh in August of 2004, and the double CD audiobook was called Jackie Leaven Said, and Jackie Leaven died a few years ago. He was a good friend of Ian Rankin's and one of his musical idols, and last few books that Ian has written have had titles derived from song lyrics, and two in a row came from songs by Jackie Leaven. And his most recent one also had a song lyric title, as you heard in the interview. It was from an album by John Martin. The previous book, the song title, was from a band called The Associates. Ian loves his music. And I checked out his Twitter feed when he was on book tour this week. And he was down in Houston, Texas, and he was very excited because he'd heard about a record store that had some great vinyl LPs that he could dig through, and he was delighted about that. And at the end of the interview that we recorded today, Peter Hayes, who does all my sound work, he did something very unusual. He picked up the phone and he started talking about music with Ian Rankin. He got excited about the sensational Alex Harvey Band, and they had a little music chat at the end of that interview, and I wish we'd recorded it because their excitement was palpable. Coming up tomorrow in the Book Nook, we'll bring you Laird Hunt. His new novel is called The Evening Road. That's at 10:30 Sunday morning. We'll be talking to Laird Hunt as he revisits the program. You might recall that his previous book was set partially in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And if you miss interviews in the Book Nook, you can go to our website and check out our array of podcasts. We have 350 Book Nook interviews up there. You can listen to all kinds of author interviews by going to wyso.org and clicking on the Book Nook page. And I hope that you'll visit it soon, because once you start listening, you won't be able to stop. We've got the Book Nook coming your way every Saturday morning at 7 o'clock and every Sunday morning at 10:30, produced here in the studios of WYSO Public Radio. Thanks to all of you for listening, and be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 7 o'clock. We'll do it again. We'll have an interview where we'll be talking about Lost City, Found Pyramid, Understanding Alternative Archaeologies, and Pseudoscientific Practices. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis.